This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The Walkerville protests, Wisconsin. The protest tents and encampment came down at Wisconsin State Capitol after Governor Scott Walker's budget victory, slashing education, health, and other services in the state budget while increasing tax breaks for the wealthy. A week earlier, the state Supreme Court narrowly approved Walker's union-busting measures, stripping civil service unions of most of their effectiveness and eliminating the union's dues checkoff. While Walker and the Republicans may lose control of the state Senate in recall elections scheduled in July, that will come, unfortunately, too late to reverse the major damage that has been done. We'll hear from one of the workers from Wisconsin, right in New York, but we'll tell you more about that then.
Now I'll talk with key organizers, Eric Cobb, Executive Director of the South Central Wisconsin Building Trades Council, and Peter Rickman, Teaching Assistant at La Follette Law School and a member of the Teaching Assistants Association, AFT Local 3220, about the lessons learned in Wisconsin and what is to be done.
Hello.
Thanks for having us on.
It is our pleasure. We continue to draw inspiration from the initial protests against Governor Walker in Wisconsin, but the working class has been taking an awful lot of hits lately. So we brought you on to catch up with what is happening in Wisconsin, but also to continue to learn lessons and still take inspiration so that we can fight for the wages and the benefits and that which should be ours from the work that we do. And we're, of course, focusing particularly at this point in the public sector.
You're exactly right that working class people have been taking a hit lately. But what we're seeing here in Wisconsin right now and across the country is certainly the most intense and virulent attack that has come in recent memory. But this has been an ongoing problem for decades, that working people have been taking it on the chin, getting screwed over by greedy corporations and big banks. But what's, to me, most exciting about what's happening here is that for the first time in those decades, we are actually fighting back. We're actually building a movement, and it's spreading all across Wisconsin. And like you said, I think providing an inspiration actually all around the world.
Why don't we start with the most recent and talk about the passage of the budget in Wisconsin, and then go back in time and talk more about the union and how that's faring. So there were major protests. The budget was passed, but talk about the protests and what exactly happened in the budget. Eric, do you want to start with that?
Sure. Well, with the passage of the budget and all of the very, very interesting things that they decided to throw in there, seemingly at the last moment, rolling back child labor laws, rolling back animal cruelty laws, among other things, that it just seems like we're in such an odd dystopian, weird Republican fantasy. I'm not really sure where to go with that. The more you look at it and the harder you look and the more you talk about it, the more bizarre it seems. And people are outraged. And that's why we had the turnouts that we had, and we had good, hardworking people, teachers, nurses, police officers, and firefighters coming out once again, very proudly standing for what they believed to be right and getting up there and making sure that their voices were heard.
Peter, why don't you talk a little bit more in detail about what the cutbacks were in the budget and how the protests went?
Well, first of all, there was over $1 billion in cuts to public education in Wisconsin. We're a state that's always prided ourselves on having not just a great system of public education, but literally a world-class public education system. Scott Walker and his Republican cronies are rolling back the accomplishments of our state in the 20th century. On top of that, they're also making hundreds of millions of dollars of cuts in health care. They're decimating local government services to the tune of not just hundreds of millions of dollars in direct cuts, but also limiting the abilities of local communities to decide that they want to tax themselves to have a civil society in their own neck of the woods. When you add up all these cuts and the impacts that they're going to have on real, everyday working families, what we're seeing is, as Eric said, a dystopian vision of society. There's a fundamental difference between what Republicans have done in this budget and the vision that we progressives and labor movement people have, where we would say that instead of making these dramatic cuts in health care and in education that add up to billions and billions of dollars, while at the same time giving billions of dollars in tax breaks for corporations and the rich, we would build a more democratic society by making investments in people and in human services and social services and the public institutions that have always been a point of pride for the people of Wisconsin. We could spend literally hours, days, going through line by line of cuts and conscience-shocking provisions, from changes to child labor laws to, you know, the way that they've attempted now to also privatize public education in Wisconsin. But by no means would we be able to cover all the gross immorality of this. It's the sum total of all the cuts and the way that they've made bad choices about the priorities for the people of our state that have fired folks up from every corner of our state to build a real movement to fight back against a vision that is fundamentally at odds with the values and traditions of Wisconsin.
Just to deal with some more of catch-up, if you could take us, Peter, through the determination by the state Supreme Court, which actually did approve what Governor Walker was doing. What did that decision rest on?
It rested on partisanship and ideology, first and foremost. It's no secret that Republicans and conservatives have a majority on our state Supreme Court. I would like to say, as a law student, that...
Are the justices elected or are they appointed positions?
The state Supreme Court is an elected body. Justices serve for 10 years. Just this past spring, Justice David Prosser, the former Republican Speaker of the Assembly and a man who in his campaign acknowledged that he would be an ideological complement to Scott Walker on the court, won re-election by the narrowest of margins and certainly under questionable circumstances, with the most conservative county in the state engaging in what appeared to be some sort of election fraud, although we'll never know the answer because the federal government has thus far declined to investigate. Because of David Prosser's re-election in April, the Republican and conservative majority court decided to overturn a lower court judge's decision that was firmly grounded in the law and enact the union-busting, rights-stripping bill that Scott Walker and his Republican cronies put forward in February and March. So the lay of the land here is that as of June 29th, the first of its kind bill to strip workers of the basic and fundamental right to form and join unions will be the law of the land in Wisconsin. We'll lose rights, we'll lose protections, and we'll lose a fundamental piece upholding the middle class in this state.
Is anybody pursuing an appeal of that ruling?
The law itself is being challenged in federal district court. A suit was filed the very next day by a group of public sector labor unions, as well as the state affiliate of the NEA and the state AFL-CIO. I don't think we have any sense of when that challenge will be taken up, but as a law student, I can tell you that there are some strong constitutional claims around equal protection and associational freedom that get right to the heart of what our Constitution is supposed to protect.
So we've still got, as live, one way of attacking, which is through the court system. So let's take
it. And we will fight them in the courts. We will fight them at the ballot box. We will fight them in the streets, wherever we have to build this movement, to stand up for working class people. That is where they will find us. Whatever it takes, as long as it takes, we will be in their face.
Eric, but in the meantime, except for those civil service unions that I guess mostly municipal and local unions that have already had signed contracts with local and county governments, the other entities basically are stripped of most of their bargaining rights and rights to bring grievances. How do you see that playing out in terms of the very survival of these unions in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, I am in a very unique position here because with the building trades, we do have private sector workers, and that is a majority of who we represent. But we do have some public sector workers that work for these cities, these municipalities, Dane County and other counties around the state, and we do have state workers as well. So it's interesting to have these meetings with these members and take a look at some of this language that's within the budget and how they've had their rights stripped away and how can we better represent them later on down the road. Of course, a lot of what we're looking at right now is civil service law and how they are able to go through their grievance structure there. Interestingly enough, we're trying to educate the leadership as much as possible on that, as well as the rank and file, so that they know when it comes to civil service law, if they do require representation or they want representation, they still have within their own means the choice of who they want to represent them. So if they had that choice, they could go to the union and say, I still want you to represent me in this particular grievance. So that's there for them. The other thing, of course, is that you have the dues checkoff that's been removed from that, and that's a real difficulty there. And a lot of the unions are trying to either find ways that they can work together to better collect dues from their membership, or they're just kind of going their own route. A lot of members would just come in and pay by hand that way. Some of the members might be inclined to sign up for an automatic dues checkoff through their bank account and things of that nature, which is fine. It's all well and good, but I think part of the conversation that needs to be had is you have 175,000 people in this state that have just been kicked to the ground. And now you have these major labor unions coming to them and saying, I'll help you up, but I need you to give me a dollar first. And that's how some of the membership are actually looking at that. And what I'd rather see is a dialogue where it says, I'm going to outstretch my hand, I'm going to help you up, and let's talk about why I'm here and what I do for you and what the union does for you, and that you are actually the union yourself, and all of your brothers and sisters standing together create that union, and we all need to work together to prevent this type of action happening to us in the future. And oh, by the way, this does cost a nominal fee, and if you're able to afford that after you've just taken a huge 8% cut on your wages, then this is a battle that we can continue to wage. So a lot of the questions that have been raised is, what is the relationship between the union leadership and the rank and file, and how can we better solidify that? And I think the answer isn't necessarily a simple answer, but it sounds simple. It's education and organization, and it's going back to those one-on-one conversations with these members that we had had prior to dues checkoff many decades ago, and saying, let's build this relationship and let's fight together for these things, because these are all things that we can all get on board with and agree on.
Let's continue this discussion, but what some people see as the dismantling of the mass protests, the encampment, etc., that was such a shot of adrenaline for those of us in other parts of the country in the labor movement. There is a certain disheartening now. But actually, what you're positing is getting back to a more essential issue, and that is the question of what people need to understand about unions. And is that something that has to be put forward? Is there a different ideological mindset that just doesn't say that I am being materially kicked to the curb, but there are other reasons that we have to band together? And is that a possible salve to reactivate people, in effect? Peter?
Yeah, we're fighting for a way of life here. This isn't just about wages and benefits and having a grievance procedure. Don't get me wrong, those are incredibly important. And we've made great steps forward in this country because unions won those things through collective bargaining. But what we're talking about here is whether or not this is going to be a country run of, by, and for corporations and the wealthy. What we believe is that we should have a democratic society. We need to democratize the economy and politics and social relationships in general. And I know that sounds like highfalutin grad student talk, but I think if you talk to every, sure, all the listeners here would believe this as well too, you know, for the most part, that, you know, working people need to be empowered to live fulfilling lives, it's quite simply. And one of the ways that we have to win those democratic social rights is our unions. And they're coming after this way of life, getting rid of the strong countervailing powers that exist to corporations and the rich. It really is a fight for not only Wisconsin values and traditions, but this is a fundamental part of the American social fabric as well. The trade union movement is part of what made the middle class and what set apart our nation from others in the 20th century in many respects. And for so many, also made the United States a kind of a beacon. This is an ideological battle. This is a battle over a way of life. And that's why we can't see ourselves as being bound by what happens day to day or week to week. We've been facing a four-decade assault on working people in our unions and facing a multi-decade assault on the public sector. And we've created the conditions to fight back, and we've been doing it, and it feels so good. Every person I talk to who's been part of the struggle tells me about how this has been fulfilling and empowering to them, not just something that is kind of a hard slog of organizing and mobilizing, though it is that. There's a lot of hard work by a lot of talented people going into this. People say to me about how exciting it is, how inspiring it is to be a part of this themselves and see that regular people taking collective action are building a movement that really can change our state, can change our country. The labor movement wasn't built in this country in 1937. The labor movement was built in the decades leading up to those dramatic sit-down strikes in Flint and in Toledo in 1937, or the general strike of the Teamsters in Minneapolis in 1934. We built the labor movement over decades, and then we're able to contest for and win power. And that's exactly what we're doing here. And we've set ourselves up to have regular working-class people fighting and leading the way in a new movement for social and economic justice in this country. And I'm so proud to have been part of it here in Wisconsin.
Eric, are there things that you see that have been learned over the struggle over the last few months that we need to look at? Especially I'm thinking of the sort of balance between electoral politics and mass mobilization, but you may have other ideas. What have we learned so far that will be useful for the future?
I think that people have definitely learned the mistakes that we might have made back in November in not showing up at the polls and or falling for the same midterm flip-flop where you would normally have someone on the Democratic side win in one election, and then 2 years later the Republicans come in and start cleaning up house and picking up seats, and then it flips back and forth like that forever. It's been like that for quite some time. And people were disgruntled with the lack of change that they were promised and were led to believe that if they were to go this direction in November, that that would be the answer. Now we're obviously finding out, especially after looking at some of the numbers I've heard of, in between 30% and 40% of union members voting for the Republicans that had run for office in November. And, of course, most of them that Peter and I have spoke to of late deeply regret that and now understand that that famous term where someone says you're voting against your own best interest, and now it's actually being played out right in front of them. So it's kind of a difficult measure for them to take, but now they understand. And so that's certainly a lesson that some people have learned as well. Another lesson is now that this battle has been brought up to the forefront, people, whether they're part of a union or not, are able to look at things like collective bargaining and quality of life and understand those terms much clearer and are actually asking more questions about them. And as they learn about it, they realize, oh, if I stand up with 10, 12, 100, 1,000, 10,000 people that are like-minded, we are in a collective bargaining situation. And that's actually pretty good because we all do agree that we should all have a measure of a quality of life. We should all be able to have a decent living wage and be able to afford housing. We should all be able to feed our children and have health care and have a pension for when we retire. And these are all things that aren't new ideas. They're not grand ideas. Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944 brought forth the Second Bill of Rights, and it all talks about those very things. So it elevates the conversation, so to speak, to a level that everybody can jump on board with and go, okay, these are very, very bad measures, and we need to do something about it. And it's really neat to see the middle class doing that. As Peter kind of alluded to, the middle class has woken up, and they realize that this is a struggle, this is a battle, and it's something that we must fight every single day.
Ken, I want to jump in here and say I think you nailed it. You said there's got to be a balance between electoral politics or political action and mobilization in the streets. And that's exactly it. Movements have many faces, and there's no way that we're going to be able to save the middle class and rebuild it. There's no way we're going to be able to build real social and economic justice in Wisconsin or in this country if we don't do the both and kind of things. And I think that's one of the best lessons learned, is that we've really been able to change the social dynamic in this state by engaging in electoral political action as well as street mobilization, and they fed off of one another. And that's the kind of thing that will continue to reinforce the growing dynamism of this movement that has galvanized working class people all around this state and around the country, and even in some cases around the world.
It was such an adrenaline rush to have that mass outpouring in Wisconsin. Is that a prospect for the immediate future, particularly given some of the lessons that you, Peter, and you, Eric, have both related? Eric, do you see the labor leaders making the kind of statements to the membership and potential membership that you related just moments ago to us, and people really cohering around a progressive working class platform?
Absolutely. I am seeing some labor leaders doing that. It's actually pretty refreshing to see Richard Trumka step up and speak to National Nurses United, 1,000 nurses, and say, look, we need an independent labor movement in this country. And you go, okay, great. Now you're saying, along with some other leaders around the country as well, saying that, hey, the Dems really haven't been there in a way for us that they should have been and that, honestly, have promised to be. And we need to hold them more accountable. And you could say the same thing for the Republicans as well. So having an independent labor movement and an independent labor political movement, I think more importantly, is something that's actually viable. Just a few months ago, even 6 months ago, if someone were to mention general strike, it might be a laughable conversation. But in February and March, those were legitimate conversations. And oddly enough, you're standing in the middle of 10,000 or more people, and people are looking around and saying, yes, we're rallying. Yes, I'm excited. Yes, I've got the message. Yes, I'm on board. And everyone asks each other the same question, what's next? So that becomes an actual viable conversation for general strike. And, of course, I'm not abdicating that. I'm not saying that's what we need to do. But what I am saying is we have other means in which to fight these battles. And when you start talking like that, you can go ahead and move the conversations toward the political realm and say, do we possibly have room for more than two parties here? Is there something else that can better represent us? I have a colleague of mine who actually mentioned Tea Party, Tea Party, Tea Party, and look at what they're doing. Well, why shouldn't we have a more left of Democrat party that actually represents working people in this country? You take a good hard look at this country, and you see the largest constituency is working people. So why wouldn't you create and build a platform that says, I am here to fight for working people's rights?
Well, we're going to leave it there. What better place by saying, really, don't mourn, indeed, organize, which is clearly continuing in Wisconsin. The note in Wisconsin has evoked a harmony of voices in sympathy and concern throughout this country, and we hope will begin to re-stimulate mass labor movement organizing. We have been speaking with Eric Cobb, Executive Director of the South Central Wisconsin Building Trades Council, and Peter Rickman, Teaching Assistant at La Follette Law School. And we thank you both for the work that you have been doing, and we will continue to pay close attention to what is happening in Wisconsin and the rejuvenation of the labor movement.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Always.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Great.
And now we hear from LaTonya Johnson, president of Wisconsin Child Care Providers Together, Local 502, AFSCME, as she linked issues and causes with public sector workers recently in protest by the tens of thousands organized by New York City's District Council 37, AFSCME.
I'm a licensed family child care provider in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm the proud president of Wisconsin Child Care Providers Together, Local 502, and I'm an Ask Me Next waiver. My center cares for 100% low-income children. These are the most impoverished and at-risk children in our city. I will never become a millionaire doing what I do. And I will never receive the respect or the recognition I deserve for doing what I do. But I'm just one of over a million public sector employees who get up and go to work every day to make our communities a better place to live. No one cares more about our communities than AFSCME, public sector employees. We provide the essential services, the same services that so many people take for granted. And we go to work every day. And we make our communities safe. And we make them clean. And we make them a place for people to call home. And we do this because we care. My grandmother used to have a saying. She said, history always repeats itself. If you fail to remember the lesson, on November 2nd, 2010, we proved my grandmother right. We allowed history to repeat itself. Too many of us stayed home and we didn't go to the polls. And we didn't support the people who support the working class citizens. In Wisconsin, because we stayed home, our schools are facing multi-million dollar cuts. Our low-income families are having to choose between going to work and leaving their kids at home alone because they can't afford child care. And our unions are being stripped of their collective bargaining rights because we failed to remember that right here in New York, so many years ago, 146 people died in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire because of poor working conditions. See, we've been accustomed to the 5-day, 40-hour work week, but we fail to remember that people lost their lives, like in the Chicago Haymarket Square or in the Bayview Massacre. People lost their lives marching for the 8-hour day. We fail to remember the Memphis sanitation strike death. And we fail to remember Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who died in Memphis, coming to the aid of our AFSCME workers, Local 1733. We fail to remember what we are fighters. And together, we are the protectors of our public sector employees. Now, I'm not standing here to say that we don't have a difficult road before us. And I'm not saying that things might get worse before they get better. But what I am saying is that we can do it together. It might be a different day. It might be a different time. But the fight and what's at stake is the same. Now, I wasn't alive when Dr. Martin Luther King went to Memphis to march with the sanitation workers. But I was there when Jesse Jackson came to Madison to march for collective bargaining. I refuse to allow history to repeat itself, and I not to do my part to correct this wrong. You can't mess with New York. And not see Wisconsin coming to its aid. Because we are family. And we got 1.6 million brothers and sisters ready to join in this fight. Fighting is what we're used to. And fighting is what we gonna do. We are going to take back our government. We're going to take back our jobs. We're going to take back our rights as workers. And we're going to take back our place in history. Together, in solidarity, we make America happen.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.